Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Seeds and Weeds Podcast, brought to you by Small House Farm. Join us as we talk with gardeners, foragers, herbalists, chefs, and community activists to explore the many ways that plants impact our cultures and cuisines, our history, and our future. I'm your host, Bevan Cohen, and this is Seeds and Weeds. Hello, welcome back to the show, my friends. We've got a very informative and important episode for you today. We're going to be sitting down with Michelle Ajamian. She's the co-founder of the Shagbark Seed Mill, and we're going to be talking about localized food systems, growing and processing staple crops like corn and beans, and we're going to explore the intersection where growers, producers, and consumers come together to decide what kind of food system do we want for ourselves and for our communities. It is a very interesting conversation, so please stick around for that. Here at Small House Farm, we finally had the time to get some seeds started, so that's an exciting development. Our little vacation after the seed swap put us about a week or so behind where we might normally be starting our seeds, but there is still plenty of time for planting. We just started some herbs and some perennials since, you know, they always take a little bit longer. When this airs, we're going to be about a little less than 8 weeks out from our typical last frost date, which usually hits around May 15. So pretty soon, we're going to be starting things like eggplants and peppers, and between 4 to 6 weeks out, we're going to get our tomatoes going. Maybe we'll do a little variety profile rundown over on our YouTube, maybe in our Facebook group. We'll see if we have time for that. If we do, it'll be fun to show you guys what all we're going to be growing. Speaking of tomatoes, a couple episodes ago, we did a little segment about that new GMO purple tomato from Norfolk Plant Science. I asked y'all for some feedback, you know, I want to hear what our listeners thought about the new variety. And for the most part, it seems like y'all feel about the same way. The general consensus from those of you that I've heard from was a resounding no thank you. There's so many wonderful tomato varieties out there and so many other foods that are already high in anthocyanin and antioxidants. Why is this tomato even necessary? Now, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be back on the Pantry Chat podcast with Carolyn Thomas, and we're going to be digging into that GMO tomato a little bit further. We really want to explore the impact that it might have on gardeners, homesteaders, and seed savers. When that episode is live, I'll have a link for it. I'll be sure to let you know so you can tune in. Today's episode of Seeds and Weeds is brought to you by our amazing community on Patreon. Their membership allows us to continue offering this program, and we are very thankful for that support. You can join our Patreon community and support the Seeds and Weeds podcast for as little as $3 a month. Membership perks include free heirloom seeds, seasonal gift baskets, and access to our special herb co-op. You can find more information at seedsandweedspodcast.com or directly at patreon.com/smallhousefarm. Michelle Ajamian launched the Appalachian Staple Foods Collaborative in 2009, and she's the co-founder of Shagbark Seed and Mill, an organic processing facility dedicated to the development of a regional model for the production and processing of staple grains, beans, oilseeds, and nut crops. Today, Michelle is joining us on the show to talk about her work at Shagbark Mill, Staple Foods, and the role that they play in a sustainable food system. Hello, Michelle. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited about talking with you.
Now, before we just jump into things, could you just tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and the work that you do?
Sure thing. My name is Michelle Ajamian, and I'm in Appalachia, actually in Southeast Ohio, which has 29 counties that are part of Appalachia. I own a mill here, Shagbark Seed and Mill. We grind flour and grits and all kinds of things like that. And we also do seed cleaning. So we have dry beans and popcorn as well. And I am also the network manager for the Appalachian Staple Foods Collaborative. Now that started back in 2009 or something, but it just moved over to Rural Action as a real part of a nonprofit back in 2019. And we work with folks all over the region as well as outside of the region, particularly millers and farmers who are growing nuts and grain and dry beans or processing them.
So let's dig a little bit into these organizations and how that they work together. But also, could you tell us a little bit about, like, what is a staple food? So we'll get real simple here. What is a staple food and why is that an important part, a vital part of a local food system?
I love that you use the word vital about staple foods. And I'm really glad you asked that question because, you know, it's up for grabs. Many people say, well, potatoes are staples and, you know, other things. But what I'm talking about is staple seed crops. So those are the seeds we eat, right? In one form or another. And so that includes beans, dry beans, grain, nuts, and pseudo cereals like amaranth and quinoa and buckwheat, for example. And why they're important is, I'm glad you asked that question as well, because they constitute the major part of diets worldwide and have since the dawn of agriculture. And really, without them, humans would not have enough nourishment. We all love kale or whatever, broccoli, what have you, but you really can't live on that. What we live on are these crops. And another wrinkle about why they're important, Big Ag knows they're important. And I think it's important that each region has food security and therefore has the whole value and supply chain within the region for these crops, because many of those crops are developed for yield and not for nutrition and not, you know, and chemical resistance. We've got GMOs that fall under those crops. So yeah, we need a diverse diet of those crops in our region, controlled by farmers and communities, and taking good care of the soil and the water. And then we're all happy.
That's very interesting to think about, you know, if a majority of our calories in our diet each day come from these particular staple crops. But then if we compare that to, say, when I go to my local farmer's market, that is represented by a minority of farmers. There might be one guy, if I'm lucky, that's selling beans and grains at my farmer's market. A dozen guys selling tomatoes and kale, maybe one guy selling the staple crop. And I think that that's an interesting thing to reflect upon when, like you said, these staple crops are actually a majority of our diet, yet we don't really see them offered in our local food system.
You know, you've just hit on why I got into this to begin with, because back in 2007, 2008, I was here and there traveling from one community to another and noticed that those crops are not being represented at farmers markets. And early on, my business partner, Brandon, you know, before Shag Bark even existed, he and I wrote a grant to USDA SARE, the North Central Region SARE program, to test high nutrition staple crops in Appalachia. And that was our motivation. It's like, okay, well, we want to eat local, but when we go to the food co-op or wherever we go to get our bulk beans and stuff, we found out that they were coming from China, you know, which there's not very much food security. And then there's the whole climate question, right? Like, are we going to be able to transport crop from all over the world? And what are the climate emergencies or implications for different regions that we currently depend on to grow those crops? We've seen drought and flood worldwide. And, you know, let's try to build a network of regions that work together and make these crops available to everybody.
Did you find that it was a lack of growers of these staple crops in your region, or was it a lack of a market or processing facility? So these growers had to ship their beans and grains elsewhere to be able to stay in business.
Wow, you're asking all the right questions. I mean, you know, so what we thought when we did that little grant, so that was like a $5,800 grant from USDA back then. And I think it's increased to around $8,000 or more at this point. But when we did that, we had this very romantic idea that we were going to be on our tractors or with our sides, and we were going to turn all these hay fields and our area of Appalachia into like high nutrition crop growing, and that we were going to grow them. But then we realized that there are plenty of farmers who are actually certified organic farmers who know how to grow these crops, but it doesn't matter if they're growing the crops and there's no place to process them. You're right. They wind up in a big elevator. Even the organic farmers are sending their stuff to a place where they get blended with other organic crop. I mean, I think one of them is up in Michigan, actually. And I just want to insert this little anecdote that is really important. The farmers that we partner with have repeatedly told us that until they were working with us, they never tasted the crop they grew. They never got the cornmeal back or the grits back or the flour back. They never got to taste it. So every year, you know, every farmer gets like a package of all the things, right? Not only what they grew, but what other farmers grew, because that's important. It's important for us to eat what we grow.
That is awesome. That's very, very cool. So once you guys got the shag bark up and running and that sort of thing, what was some of the first products that you worked with?
Dry beans. So we did pinto. I don't know if we did pinto right out the gate. I think it was black beans first. And then we added pinto and adzuki beans. And adzuki beans and pinto, first adzuki beans fell away because they just don't grow that well in Ohio. And we are kind of focused on in as much as we can, which is like 98% of what we process. We want it to be grown in Ohio so that we're like really within a few hundred miles of the farmer. So I think actually most farmers are within 150 miles of us. And yeah, there's the occasion where we go to Michigan because we ran out of something. You know, you have to plan your field so far in advance, and we have to project far in advance. So we have had that occasional good problem to have where we projected, but then a bigger order shows up and we had to go up to Michigan and get black beans or maybe to Western Pennsylvania. So we started with the beans. We pretty quickly were doing corn. We do Wapsie Valley corn, which is organic also. Everything's organic except for our popcorn. We do a hybrid organic corn, and that's the corn that goes into our tortilla chips and also into, well, we used to do fresh tortillas with a tortilleria, but we haven't done that for over a year now. We haven't done nuts. We've shied away from doing nuts because of the allergen issue question, but through the Appalachian Staple Foods Collaborative, I just completed a 2-year project with a co-op of nut growers, of chestnut growers up in Carroll County in Ohio, and that is Route 9 Cooperative. And so we worked with them through the Staple Foods Collaborative to identify a mill that was close enough to them to start looking at how to add value to the chestnuts that weren't the pristine, big, grade A chestnuts that they harvest.
Oh, I like that. We'll come back to those chestnuts in a second. So let's go back to the Shag Bark, the online store there. I was checking out the shop. You guys got some really cool stuff there. What are some of your best-selling, most popular items that you offer?
Well, you know, I don't keep tabs on what is best selling through this online store, but I can tell you that black beans and tortilla chips are our biggest sellers.
So let's go back to those chestnuts then. Let's dig a little bit more, if we could, into the Appalachian Staple Food Collaborative. What that is that a nonprofit organization then?
So the Staple Foods Collaborative, actually, we started that before Shag Bark existed, or we even knew we were going to the Shag Bark entity, you know, start a business. And we just started it as an informal network. Like, how do we, you know, kind of create a container in which we can build the network for interest and stakeholders who want to think about building a local or a regional staple food system for any community? But of course, we were starting with our own community. So that was back in 2008. And out of that, we had like a little advisory board. I mean, so it wasn't a nonprofit. It wasn't a for-profit. It was just, you know, a network, right?
Sure.
We had some volunteers meet with us and advise us. And it was with that group that we realized a little reluctantly that we weren't going to be farming this stuff. We were going to be setting up a facility to mill it and do all of that. So yeah, they really helped us see where the hole in the system was. And the hole in the system, you must have seen this yourself, like every town, pretty much every town in North America, maybe in Canada too, has a mill street or a mill road or, you know, something with mill creek. And the mills are gone. They disappeared, right? They didn't really make it. Going back to like the big ag footprint for these crops, most of the crop that is staple seed crops, corn and beans are the big ones, right? Are grown for feed. Like very little of it, I mean, it's changing, but very little of it is grown for human consumption, for direct human consumption. You know, chickens need to eat corn. Cows really don't need to eat grain, but, you know, they're fed grain, unfortunately, in higher amounts than they should ever eat. When you're going through the Midwest and you just see field after field of corn and soybeans, humans are probably not going to be eating any of that unless unless it's indirectly through, you know, the meat and the milk and the chickens and the eggs.
Sure. And also, I would assume ethanol production as well, as far as that corn goes.
Yeah. You know, I haven't kept up on that. I mean, I know back in 2010, around there, I was reading more about it. Like, what percentage of the corn grown is going to ethanol? So I don't know what the current numbers are, but it was kind of shocking. If we have hungry people, why are we using food to make fuel?
It's shocking. That's a very polite way to put it. One thing that I love that you're doing, you know, I mean, you're dealing with local farmers, Ohio farmers, producing locally grown products, regionally appropriate products that you are then offering, like you said, to schools and grocery stores and farmers markets in Ohio, a little bit outside Ohio, but for the most part in Ohio.
Yeah.
You're making it work and it's super local. It's regional. It's profitable, I'm hoping, and it's working for everybody. And you're doing it on the proper scale. You're not trying to expand into the biggest possible thing. You're doing exactly what your community needs. And that is so cool.
Yeah. I mean, I feel really proud of that, but I also want to admit that there's a tension point there. You have to have a certain amount of revenue to generate enough money to pay people well. It's a tension point. I think that's a really important thing to think about. Like, how do we, you know, create kind of a think tank around sustainable regional food? How do we make it work so that everybody involved, not only all the people who are farming, getting the seed together, milling, seed cleaning, the restaurant people, all of that. Everybody needs to make a living wage. And then it's like, oh, wait a minute. What about the people who want to buy that food? They all need to make a living wage. And this is where we get into a much bigger topic, right? We don't need to go there today, but it's a much bigger topic in that we need to have a just society where we take care of one another and everyone has access. You know, we didn't start this to create kind of a niche that only well-off people could afford to eat. We started this because everyone deserves to have any food they want to eat. And they would if everybody was cared for properly.
At the end of the day, that's ultimately what we're trying to figure out here is how do we create products or foods that are responsible and healthy, that pay the farmers and producers well, yet at the same time are affordable to the consumer? That's the ultimate question, I think.
You know, there's this funny saying, I always like to bring the saying up. If you think crime doesn't pay, try farming. You know, I mean, it's like you get other kinds of currency as a farmer and as a miller. Like I go home with all the beans I want. So there are other benefits. But in terms of like cash flow, we really need to think about how to redirect, for example, the farm bill. The farm bill subsidizes big ag to grow corn and soy, not any other dry bean. All the other dry beans are not considered beans in terms of the subsidies that are like, I don't know, $15, $20 billion a year. How do we move that gigantic ship in the right direction so that it is actually supporting communities and regions to be able to take care of themselves and the people that live there, everybody, not just certain people?
I don't have an answer to that question, obviously, but I do think that the work that you are doing down in Southern Ohio is certainly a step in the right direction.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, we're all in it together. You're doing it too. And I think that it really takes all of us doing this kind of work. I mean, let me just throw this out. When we started, I think we identified like 5 to 8 mills across the country that were like milling what they grew and or farmers close by, you know, that kind of thing. And now there are hundreds. There are hundreds. And I know this because one of the things we're doing with the Appalachian Staple Foods Collaborative is we formed a peer learning group of mills around the country. And we had like 50 some mills around the country that participated in these peer learning calls. And now we formed an actual guild. I mean, it's in its baby, you know, it's in its infancy. But we've got like 27 members from around the country who pay a membership fee for access to one another and information that we're just open source sharing, you know, so it's like not holding our cards close to our chest, but saying, yeah, I know about that. Let me help you do it.
So that brings me to my next question here. Then I was going to ask if you had any advice for growers in particular that are looking to expand what they do into staple crops, or maybe looking to develop a market or work with producers to expand. What kind of advice do you have for growers to help them find a community?
I encourage people to look at the Craft Millers Guild website. It could at least give you a sense sense of where mills are around the country that are already working with us, working together, I guess is what I should say, you know, what they're doing, because each one is a little bit different.
I'm going to put that link, the Craft Millers Guild website, that's going to be down in the show notes for everybody tuning in here that are interested in checking that out. And then let's do the same question, but let's flip it over. And for consumers that are interested in supporting their local food producers, what advice do you have to offer to them to get them started?
Well, learn how to cook beans. I mean, people want to go to the store and get a can of beans, and they don't realize that it only takes organization, not time, to cook beans. You can soak beans, you walk away. You rinse beans and you turn on your Instapot, or you turn on your pressure cooker, or you turn on your just pot on the stove, and they cook in the background while you're doing other things, right? I used to do this when my kids were young. I would just like cook a big pot of beans every weekend, and those were our beans for the week, you know? And so maybe it's a lifestyle change, but a lot of people have these little pressure cookers, or what are they called? Instapots kind of thing. You can cook really well with those. So yeah, I think the number one thing I'd say to consumers is don't be afraid of cooking your own beans, because that's the way you're going to be able to buy local beans. What else would I say to consumers? I just feel like saying, don't be afraid to cook, you know, making grits in the morning for breakfast. I mean, they're like making pancakes with local flour, making muffins with local flour. There's just nothing like it. The freshness of something that was just milled in the last 2 weeks is completely different from what you get on the grocery store shelf.
Absolutely. I think that's the best possible advice, is get people out there, learn how to cook. That's fantastic advice. Michelle, what are the links that people need if they want to learn more about the Shagbark Seed and Mill or the Appalachian Staple Food Collaborative?
The Appalachian Staple Foods Collaborative is at ruralaction.org. Shagbark Seed and Mill is pretty straightforward. It's just shagbarkseedandmill.com.
Michelle, this was super fun. Thank you again for joining us today. That was awesome.
Thank you very, very much.
Here we are again at the end of another show. Thanks again to Michelle and Jamie for being our guests, and to all of you for tuning in. If you enjoy the podcast, you can always show your support by joining our Patreon community. You can find that link and many more down in the show notes and at seedsandweedspodcast.com. Today's episode was edited and produced by all of us here at Small House Farm, and the music we're enjoying right now is a little French jazz from William King. I'm Bevan Cohen, and we'll see you next time. Howdy, friends. Bevan here. You know, the Seeds and Weeds podcast is made possible in part by Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company, rareseeds.com. They're America's top source for rare and heirloom varieties from around the world, and they're publisher of the whole seed catalog. Their 2024 catalog is chocked full of heirloom goodness, new varieties, recipes, stories, and gorgeous photographs. You can order yours now at rareseeds.com.